Chapter 12. They worked hard at Hyoi's boat till noon, and then spread themselves on the weed close to the warmth of the creek and began their midday meal. The warlike nature of their preparations suggested many questions to Ransom. He knew no word for war, but he managed to make Hyoi understand what he wanted to know. Did Saroni and Hrossa and Fiffeltriggy ever go out like this, with weapons against each other?
What for? Asked Hyoi.
It was difficult to explain. If both wanted one thing and neither would give it, said Ransom, would the other at last come with force? Would they say, give it or we kill you?
What sort of thing?
Well, food, perhaps.
If the other now wanted food, why should we not give it to them? We often do.
But how, if we had not enough for ourselves?
But Maleldil will not stop the plants growing.
Hyoi, if you had more and more young, would Maleldil broaden the Handramit and make enough plants for them all?
Well, the Saroni know that sort of thing. But why should we have more young?
Ransom found this difficult. At last he said, Is the begetting of young not a pleasure among the Hrossa?
A very great one, man. This is what we call love.
Well, if a thing is pleasure, a man wants it again. He might want the pleasure more often than the number of young that could be fed.
It took Hyoi a long time to get the point.
You mean, he said slowly, that he might do it not only in 1 or 2 years of his life, but again?
Yes.
But why? Why would he want his dinner all day, or want to sleep after he had slept? I do not understand.
But a dinner comes every day. This love, you say, comes only once while the Hross lives?
But it takes his whole life. When he is young, he has to look for his mate. And then he has to court her. Then he begets young. Then he rears them. Then he remembers all this, and boils it inside him, and makes it into poems and wisdom.
But the pleasure he must be content only to remember?
Well, that is like saying, my food I must be content to eat.
I do not understand.
A pleasure is full-grown only when it is remembered. You are speaking, man, as if the pleasure were one thing and the memory another. It is all one thing. The Saroni could say it better than I say it now, not better than I could say it in a poem. What you call remembering is the last part of the pleasure, as the kra is the last part of a poem. When you and I met, the meeting was over very shortly. It was nothing. Now it is growing something as we remember it. But still we know very little about it. What it will be when I remember it as I lie down to die, what it makes in me all my days till then, that is the real meeting. The other is only the beginning of it. You say you have poets in your world. Do they not teach you this?
Well, perhaps some of them do, said Ransom. But even in a poem, does a Hross never long to hear one splendid line over again?
Hyoi's reply unfortunately turned on one of those points in their language which Ransom had not mastered. There were two verbs which both, as far as he could see, meant to long or yearn. But the Hrossa drew a sharp distinction, even an opposition, between them. Hyoi seemed to him merely to be saying that everyone would long for it, Wunderlohn, but no one in his senses could long for it, Hluntheline. And indeed, he continued, the poem is a good example, for the most splendid line becomes fully splendid only by means of all the lines after it. If you went back to it, you would find it less splendid than you thought. You would kill it. I mean, in a good poem.
But in a bent poem, Hyoi?
A bent poem is not listened to, man.
And how of love in a bent life?
How could the life of Achnau be bent?
Do you say, Hyoi, that there are no bent Hrossa?
Hyoi reflected. I have heard, he said at last, of something like what you mean. It is said that sometimes here and there a cub of a certain age gets strange twists in him. I have heard of one that wanted to eat earth. There might, perhaps, be somewhere a Hross likewise that wanted to have the years of love prolonged. I have not heard of it, but it might be. I have heard of something stranger. There is a poem about a Hross who lived long ago in another Handramit, who saw things all made two suns in the sky, two heads on a neck, and last of all they say that he fell into such a frenzy that he desired two mates. I do not ask you to believe it, but that is the story, that he loved two Hresni.
Ransom pondered this. Here, unless Hyoi was deceiving him, was a species naturally continent, naturally monogamous. And yet, was it so strange? Some animals, he knew, had regular breeding seasons. And if nature could perform the miracle of turning the sexual impulse outward at all, why could she not go further and fix it, not morally, but instinctively, to a single object? He even remembered dimly having heard that some terrestrial animals, some of the lower animals, were naturally monogamous. Among the Hrossa, anyway, it was obvious that unlimited breeding and promiscuity were as rare as the rarest perversions. At last it dawned upon him that it was not they, but his own species, that were the puzzle. That the Hrossa should have such instincts was mildly surprising. But how came it that the instincts of the Hrossa so closely resembled the unattained ideals of that far-divided species man, whose instincts were so deplorably different? What was the history of man? But Hjoy was speaking again. "Undoubtedly," he said, "Maleldil made us so. How could there ever be enough to eat if everyone had 20 young? And how could we endure to live and let time pass if we were always crying for one day or one year to come back? If we did not know that every day in a life fills the whole life with expectation and memory, and that these are that day." "All the same," said Ransom, unconsciously nettled on behalf of his own world, "Maleldil has let in the Hnakra." "Oh, but that is so different. I long to kill this Hnakra as he also longs to kill me. I hope that my ship will be the first, and I first in my ship with my straight spear when the black jaws snap. And if he kills me, my people will mourn, and my brothers will desire still more to kill him. But they will not wish that there were no Hnaraki, nor do I. How can I make you understand, when you do not understand the poets? The Hnakra is our enemy, but he is also our beloved. We feel in our hearts his joy as he looks down from the mountain of water in the north where he was born. We leap with him when he jumps the falls. And when winter comes, and the lake smokes higher than our heads, it is with his eyes that we see it, and know that his roaming time is come. We hang images of him in our houses, and the sign of all the Hrossa is a Hnakra. In him the spirit of the valley lives, and our young play at being Hnaraki as soon as they can splash in the shallows. And then he kills them? Well, not often them. The Hrossa would be bent Hrossa if they let him get so near. Long before he had come down so far, we should have sought him out. No, man, it is not a few deaths roving the world around him that make a Hnau miserable. It is a bent Hnau that would blacken the world. And I say also this, I do not think the forest would be so bright, nor the water so warm, nor love so sweet, if there were no danger in the lakes. I will tell you a day in my life that has shaped me, such a day as comes only once, like love, or serving Oyarsa in Meldilorn. Then I was young, not much more than a cub, when I went far, far up the Handramit, to a land where stars shine at midday, and even water is cold. A great waterfall I climbed. I stood on the shore of Balki, the pool, which is the place of most awe in all worlds. The walls of it go up for ever and ever, and huge and holy images are cut in them, the work of old times. There is the fall called the Mountain of Water. Because I have stood there alone, Maleldil and I, for even Oyarsa sent me no word, my heart has been higher, my song deeper all my days. Do you think it would have been so unless I had known that in Balki Hnaraki dwelled? There I drank life because death was in the pool. That was the best of drinks, save one. What one? Asked Ransom. Death itself, in the day I drink it and go to Maleldil. Shortly after that they rose and resumed their work. The sun was declining as they came back through the wood. It occurred to Ransom to ask Hjoy a question. "Hjoy," he said, "it comes into my head that when I first saw you, and before you saw me, you were already speaking. That was how I knew that you were Hnau, for otherwise I should have thought you a beast and run away. But who were you speaking to?"
"To an Eldil."
"What is that?"
"I saw no one."
"Are there no Eldila in your world, man? That must be strange."
"But what are they?"
"Oh, they come from Oyarsa. They are, I suppose, a kind of Hnau. As we came out today, I passed a child who said she was talking to an Eldil, but I could see nothing."
"One can see by looking at your eyes, man, that they are different from ours. But Eldila are hard to see. They are not like us. Light goes through them. You must be looking in the right place and the right time, and that is not likely to come about unless the Eldil wishes to be seen. Sometimes you can mistake them for a sunbeam, or even a moving of the leaves, but when you look again, you see that it was an Eldil, and that it is gone.
but whether your eyes can ever see them, I do not know. The Sirone would know that.
Chapter 13. The whole village was astir next morning before the sunlight, already visible on the Harandra, had penetrated the forest. By the light of the cooking fires, Ransom saw an incessant activity of Hrossa. The females were pouring out steaming food from clumsy pots. Hnora was directing the transportation of piles of spears to the boats. Hyoi, in the midst of a group of the most experienced hunters, was talking too rapidly and too technically for Ransom to follow. Parties were arriving from the neighbouring villages, and the cubs, squealing with excitement, were running hither and thither among their elders. He found that his own share in the hunt had been taken for granted. He was to be in Hyoi's boat, with Hyoi and Huynh. The two Hrossa would take it in turns to paddle, while Ransom and the disengaged Hross would be in the bows. He understood the Hrossa well enough now to know that they were making him the noblest offer in their power, and that Hyoi and Huynh were each tormented by the fear he should be paddling when the Hnakra appeared. A short time ago, in England, nothing would have seemed more impossible to Ransom than to accept the post of honour and danger in attack upon an unknown but certainly deadly aquatic monster. Even more recently, when he had first fled from the Sorns, or when he had lain pitying himself in the forest by night, it would hardly have been in his power to do what he was intending to do today. For his intention was clear. Whatever happened, he must show that the human species also were now. He was only too well aware that such resolutions might look very different when the moment came, but he felt an unwonted assurance that somehow or other he would be able to go through with it. It was necessary, and the necessary was always possible. Perhaps, too, there was something in the air he now breathed, or in the society of the Hrossa, which had begun to work a change in him. The lake was just giving back the first rays of the sun when he found himself kneeling side by side with Huynh, as he had been told to, in the bows of Hyoi's ship, with a little pile of throwing spears between his knees and one in his right hand, stiffening his body against the motion as Hyoi paddled them out into their place. At least 100 boats were taking part in the hunt. They were in 3 parties. The central, and far the smallest, was to work its way up the current by which Hyoi and Ransom had descended after their first meeting. Longer ships than he had yet seen, 8 paddled ships, were used for this. The habit of the Hnakra was to float down the current whenever he could. Meeting the ships, he would presumably dart out of it into the still water to let the party slowly beat up the current. The light ships, paddling far faster, would cruise at will up and down either side of it, to receive the quarry as soon as he broke what might be called his cover. In this game, numbers and intelligence were on the side of the Hrossa. The Hnakra had speed on his side, and also invisibility, for he could swim under water. He was nearly invulnerable, except through his open mouth. If the 2 hunters in the bows of the boat he made for muffed their shots, this was usually the last of them and of their boat. In the light skirmishing parties there were 2 things a brave hunter could aim at. He could keep well back and close to the long ships, where the Hnakra was most likely to break out, or he could get as far forward as possible, in the hope of meeting the Hnakra going at its full speed and yet untroubled by the hunt, and of inducing it, by a well-aimed spear, to leave the current then and there. One could thus anticipate the beaters and kill the beast, if that was how the matter ended, on one's own. This was the desire of Hyoi and Huynh, and almost, so strongly they infected him, of Ransom. Hence, hardly had the heavy craft of the beaters begun their slow progress up current amid a wall of foam, when he found his own ship speeding northward as fast as Hyoi could drive her, already passing boat after boat and making for the freest water. The speed was exhilarating. In the cold morning the warmth of the blue expanse they were clearing was not unpleasant. Behind them arose, re-echoed from the remote rock pinnacles on either side of the valley, the bell-like, deep-mouthed voices of more than 200 Hrossa, more musical than a cry of hounds, but closely akin to it in quality as in purport. Something long sleeping in the blood awoke in Ransom. It did not seem impossible at this moment that even he might be the Hnakra slayer, that the fame of Man Hnakrapont might be handed down to posterity in this world that knew no other man. But he had had such dreams before, and knew how they ended. Imposing humility on the newly risen riot of his feelings, he turned his eyes to the troubled water of the current, which they were skirting without entering, and watched intently. For a long time nothing happened. He became conscious of the stiffness of his attitude and deliberately relaxed his muscles. Presently, Huynh reluctantly went aft to paddle, and Hyoi came forward to take his place. Almost as soon as the change had been effected, Hyoi spoke softly to him and said, without taking his eyes off the current, "There is an Eldil coming to us over the water." Ransom could see nothing, or nothing that he could distinguish from imagination and the dance of sunlight on the lake. A moment later, Hyoi spoke again, but not to him. "What is it, Skyborn?" What happened next was the most uncanny experience Ransom had yet had on Malakandra. He heard the voice. It seemed to come out of the air, about a yard above his head, and it was almost an octave higher than the Hross's, higher even than his own. He realized that a very little difference in his ear would have made the Eldil as inaudible to him as it was invisible.
"It is the man with you, Hyoi," said the voice. "He ought not to be there. He ought to be going to Oyarsa. Bent now of his own kind from Thalkandra are following him. He should go to Oyarsa. If they find him anywhere else, there will be evil."
"He hears you, Skyborn," said Hyoi. "And have you no message for my wife? You know what she wishes to be told."
"I have a message for Hleri," said the Eldil, "but you will not be able to take it. I go to her now myself. All that is well. Only let the man go to Oyarsa."
There was a moment's silence. "He is gone," said Huynh, "and we have lost our share in the hunt." "Yes," said Hyoi with a sigh. "We must put Man ashore and teach him the way to Meldilorn." Ransom was not so sure of his courage, but that one part of him felt an instant relief at the idea of any diversion from their present business. But the other part of him urged him to hold on to his new-found manhood. Now or never, with such companions or with none, he must leave a deed on his memory instead of one more broken dream. It was in obedience to something like conscience that he exclaimed, "No, no, there is time for that after the hunt. We must kill the Hnakra first." "Once an Eldil has spoken," began Hyoi, when suddenly Huynh gave a great cry, a bark, Ransom would have called it 3 weeks ago, and pointed. There, not a furlong away, was the torpedo-like track of foam, and now, visible through a wall of foam, they caught the metallic glint of the monster's sides. Huynh was paddling furiously. Hyoi threw and missed. As his first spear smote the water, his second was already in the air. This time it must have touched the Hnakra. He wheeled right out of the current. Ransom saw the great black pit of his mouth twice open and twice shut with its snap of shark-like teeth. He himself had thrown now, hurriedly, excitedly, with unpracticed hand. "Back!" shouted Hyoi to Huynh, who was already backing water with every pound of his vast strength. Then all became confused. He heard Huynh shout, "Sure!" There came a shock that flung him forward, almost into the Hnakra's jaws, and he found himself at the same moment up to his waist in water. It was at him the teeth were snapping. Then, as he flung shaft after shaft into the great cavern of the gaping brute, he saw Hyoi perched incredibly on its back, on its nose, bending forward and hurling from there. Almost at once the Hross was dislodged and fell with a wide splash nearly 10 yards away. But the Hnakra was killed. It was wallowing on its side, bubbling out its black life. The water around him was dark and stank. When he recollected himself, they were all on shore, wet, steaming, trembling with exertion, and embracing one another. It did not now seem strange to him to be clasped to a breast of wet fur. The breath of the Hrossa, which, though sweet, was not human breath, did not offend him. He was one with them. That difficulty which they, accustomed to more than one rational species, had perhaps never felt, was now overcome. They were all, now. They had stood shoulder to shoulder in the face of an enemy, and the shapes of their heads no longer mattered. And he, even Ransom, had come through it and not been disgraced. He had grown up. They were on a little promontory free of forest, on which they had run aground in the confusion of the fight. The wreckage of the boat and the corpse of the monster lay confused together in the water beside them. No sound from the rest of the hunting party was audible. They had been almost a mile ahead when they met the Hnakra. All three sat down to recover their breath. "So," said Hyoi, "we are Hnakra Punti. This is what I have wanted all my life." At that moment, Ransom was deafened by a loud sound, a perfectly familiar sound which was the last thing he expected to hear. It was a terrestrial, human, and civilized sound. It was even European. It was the crack of an English rifle, and Hyoy, at his feet, was struggling to rise and gasping. There was blood on the white weed where he struggled. Ransom dropped on his knees beside him. The huge body of the Hross was too heavy for him to turn round. Wynne helped him. "Hyoy, can you hear me?" said Ransom, with his face close to the round seal-like head. "Hyoy, it is through me that this has happened. It is the other Mana who have hit you, the bent two that brought me to Malakandra. They can throw death at a distance with a thing they have made. I should have told you. We are all a bent race. We have come here to bring evil on Malakandra. We are only half now. Hyoy—" His speech died away into the inarticulate. He did not know the words for forgive, or shame, or fault, hardly the word for sorry. He could only stare into Hyoy's distorted face in speechless guilt. But the Hross seemed to understand. It was trying to say something, and Ransom laid his ear close to the working mouth. Hyoy's dulling eyes were fixed on his own, but the expression of a Hross was not even now perfectly intelligible to him. "Na, ma," it muttered, and then at last, "Man, Nakrapunt." Then there came a contortion of the whole body, a gush of blood and saliva from the mouth. His arms gave way under the sudden dead weight of the sagging head, and Hyoy's face became as alien and animal as it had seemed at their first meeting. The glazed eyes and the slowly stiffening, bedraggled fur were like those of any dead beast found in an earthly wood. Ransom resisted an infantile impulse to break out into imprecations on Western and Divine. Instead, he raised his eyes to meet those of Wynne, who was crouching, "Hrossa, do not kneel," on the other side of the corpse. "I am in the hands of your people, Wynne," he said. "They must do as they will. But if they are wise, they will kill me, and certainly they will kill the other two." "One does not kill now," said Wynne. "Only Oyarsa does that." "But these other, where are they?" Ransom glanced around. It was open on the promontory, but thick wood came down to where it joined the mainland, perhaps 200 yards away. "Somewhere in the wood," he said. "Lie down, Wynne, here where the ground is lowest. They may throw from their thing again." He had some difficulty in making Wynne do as he suggested. When both were lying in dead ground, their feet almost in the water, the Hross spoke again. "Why did they kill him?" he asked. "They would not know he was Hnau," said Ransom. "I have told you that there is only one kind of Hnau in our world. They would think he was a beast. If they thought that, they would kill him for pleasure, or in fear, or," he hesitated, "because they were hungry. But I must tell you the truth, Wynne. They would kill even a Hnau, knowing it to be a Hnau, if they thought its death would serve them." There was a short silence. "I am wondering," said Ransom, "if they saw me. It is for me they are looking. Perhaps if I went to them they would be content and come no farther into your land. But why do they not come out of the wood to see what they have killed?" "Our people are coming," said Wynne, turning his head. Ransom looked back and saw the lake black with boats. The main body of the hunt would be with them in a few minutes. "They are afraid of the Hrossa," said Ransom. "That is why they do not come out of the wood." "I will go to them, Wynne." "No," said Wynne. "I have been thinking. All this has come from not obeying the Eldil. He said you were to go to Oyarsa. You ought to have been already on the road. You must go now." "But that will leave the bent Mana here. They may do more harm." "They will not set on the Hrossa. You have said they are afraid. It is more likely that we will come upon them." "Never fear. They will not see us or hear us. We will take them to Oyarsa. But you must go now, as the Eldil said. Your people will think I have run away because I am afraid to look in their faces after Hyoi's death. It is not a question of thinking, but of what an Eldil says. This is cub's talk. Now listen, and I will teach you the way." The Hross explained to him that 5 days' journey to the south, the Hadramit joined another Hadramit, and 3 days up this other Hadramit to west and north was Meldilorn, and the seat of Oyarsa. But there was a shorter way, a mountain road across the corner of the Harandra between the two canyons, which would bring him down to Meldilorn on the second day. He must go into the wood before them and through it till he came to the mountain wall of the Hadramit, and he must work south along the roots of the mountains till he came to a road cut up between them. Up this he must go, and somewhere beyond the tops of the mountains he would come to the Tower of Orgre. Orgre would help him. He could cut weed for his food before he left the forest and came into the rock country. Wynne realized that Ransom might meet the other two Hmana as soon as he entered the wood. "If they catch you," he said, "then it will be as you say. They will come no farther into our land. But it is better to be taken on your way to Oyarsa than to stay here. And once you are on your way to him, I do not think he will let the Bent Ones stop you." Ransom was by no means convinced that this was the best plan, either for himself or for the Hrossa. But the stupor of humiliation in which he had lain ever since Hyoi fell forbade him to criticize. He was anxious only to do whatever they wanted him to do, to trouble them as little as was now possible, and above all, to get away. It was impossible to find out how Wynne felt, and Ransom sternly repressed an insistent, whining impulse to renewed protestations and regrets, self-accusations that might elicit some word of pardon. Hyoi, with his last breath, had called him Hnakra Slayer. That was forgiveness generous enough, and with that he must be content. As soon as he had mastered the details of his route, he bade farewell to Wynne and advanced alone towards the forest. Chapter 14. Until he reached the wood, Ransom found it difficult to think of anything except the possibility of another rifle bullet from Weston or Divine. He thought that they probably still wanted him alive rather than dead, and this, combined with the knowledge that a Hross was watching him, enabled him to proceed with at least external composure. Even when he had entered the forest, he felt himself in considerable danger. The long, branchless stems made cover only if you were very far away from the enemy. And the enemy, in this case, might be very close. He became aware of a strong impulse to shout out to Weston and Divine and give himself up. It rationalized itself in the form that this would remove them from the district, as they would probably take him off to the Sorns and leave the Hrossa unmolested. But Ransom knew a little psychology and had heard of the hunted man's irrational instinct to give himself up. Indeed, he had felt it himself in dreams. It was some such trick, he thought, that his nerves were now playing him. In any case, he was determined henceforward to obey the Hrossa or Eldila. His efforts to rely on his own judgment in Malakandra had so far ended tragically enough. He made a strong resolution, defying in advance all changes of mood, that he would faithfully carry out the journey to Meldilorn if it could be done. This resolution seemed to him all the more certainly right, because he had the deepest misgivings about that journey. He understood that the Harandra, which he had to cross, was the home of the Sorns. In fact, he was walking of his own free will into the very trap that he had been trying to avoid ever since his arrival on Malakandra. Here the first change of mood tried to raise its head. He thrust it down. And even if he got through the Sorns and reached Meldilorn, who or what might Oyarsa be? Oyarsa, Wynne had ominously observed, did not share the Hrossa's objection to shedding the blood of a Hnau. And again, Oyarsa ruled Sorns as well as Hrossa and Fifeltrigi. Perhaps he was simply the arch-Sorn. And now came the second change of mood. Those old terrestrial fears of some alien, cold intelligence, superhuman in power, subhuman in cruelty, which had utterly faded from his mind among the Hrossa, rose clamoring for readmission. But he strode on. He was going to Meldilorn. It was not possible, he told himself, that the Hrossa should obey any evil or monstrous creature. And they had told him, or had they, he was not quite sure, that Oyarsa was not a Sorn. Was Oyarsa a god? Perhaps that very idol to whom the Sorns wanted to sacrifice him. But the Hrossa, though they said strange things about him, clearly denied that he was a god. There was one god, according to them, Maleldil the Young. Nor was it possible to imagine Hyoi or Hnora worshipping a blood-stained idol. Unless, of course, the Hrossa were, after all, under the thumb of the Sorns. Superior to their masters in all the qualities that human beings value, but intellectually inferior to them, and dependent on them. It would be a strange but not an inconceivable world. Heroism and poetry at the bottom, cold scientific intellect above it, and overtopping all, some dark superstition, which scientific intellect, helpless against the revenge of the emotional depths it had ignored, had neither will nor power to remove. A mumbo-jumbo. But Ransom pulled himself up. He knew too much now to talk that way. He and all his class would have called the Eldela a superstition if they had been merely described to them. But now he had heard the voice himself. No, Oyarsa was a real person, if he was a person at all. He had now been walking for about an hour, and it was nearly midday. No difficulty about his direction had yet occurred. He had merely to keep going uphill, and he was certain of coming out of the forest to the mountain wall sooner or later. Meanwhile he felt remarkably well, though greatly chastened in mind. The silent, purple half-light of the woods spread all around him, as it had spread on the first day he spent in Malacandra. But everything else was changed. He looked back on that time as on a nightmare, on his own mood at that time as a sort of sickness. Then all had been whimpering, unanalyzed, self-nourishing, self-consuming dismay. Now, in the clear light of an accepted duty, he felt fear indeed, but with it a sober sense of confidence in himself and in the world, and even an element of pleasure. It was the difference between a landsman in a sinking ship and a horseman on a bolting horse. Either may be killed, but the horseman is an agent as well as a patient. About an hour after noon he suddenly came out of the wood into bright sunshine. He was only 20 yards from the almost perpendicular bases of the mountain spires, too close to them to see their tops. A sort of valley ran up in the re-entrant between two of them at the place where he had emerged, an unclimbable valley consisting of a single concave sweep of stone, which in its lower parts ascended steeply as the roof of a house, and farther up seemed almost vertical. At the top it even looked as if it hung over a bit, like a tidal wave of stone at the very moment of breaking. But this, he thought, might be an illusion. He wondered what the Hrosser's idea of a road might be. He began to work his way southward along the narrow, broken ground between wood and mountain. Great spurs of the mountains had to be crossed every few moments, and even in that lightweight world it was intensely tiring. After about half an hour he came to a stream. Here he went a few paces into the forest, cut himself an ample supply of the groundweed, and sat down beside the water's edge for lunch. When he had finished, he filled his pockets with what he had not eaten, and proceeded. He began soon to be anxious about his road, for if he could make the top at all, he could do it only by daylight, and the middle of the afternoon was approaching. But his fears were unnecessary. When it came, it was unmistakable. An open way through the wood appeared on the left. He must be somewhere behind the Hross village now, and on the right he saw the road, a single ledge, or in places a trench, cut sidewise and upwards across the sweep of such a valley as he had seen before. It took his breath away. The insanely steep, hideously narrow staircase without steps, leading up and up from where he stood to where it was an almost invisible thread on the pale green surface of the rock. But there was no time to stand and look at it. He was a poor judge of heights, but he had no doubt that the top of the road was removed from him by a more than alpine distance. It would take him at least till sundown to reach it. Instantly he began the ascent. Such a journey would have been impossible on earth. The first quarter of an hour would have reduced a man of Ransom's build and age to exhaustion. Here he was at first delighted with the ease of his movement, and then staggered by the gradient and length of the climb which, even under Malacandrian conditions, soon bowed his back and gave him an aching chest and trembling knees. But this was not the worst. He heard already a singing in his ears, and noticed that despite his labour there was no sweat on his forehead. The cold, increasing at every step, seemed to sap his vitality worse than any heat could have done. Already his lips were cracked, his breath, as he panted, showed like a cloud. His fingers were numb. He was cutting his way up into a silent Arctic world, and had already passed from an English to a Lapland winter. It frightened him, and he decided that he must rest here or not at all. 100 paces more, and if he sat down he would sit for ever. He squatted on the road for a few minutes, slapping his body with his arms. The landscape was terrifying. Already the Hadramit, which had made his world for so many weeks, was only a thin purple cleft sunk amidst the boundless level desolation of the Harandra, which now, on the farther side, showed clearly between and above the mountain peaks. But long before he was rested, he knew that he must go on or die. The world grew stranger. Among the Hrossa he had almost lost the feeling of being on a strange planet. Here it returned upon him with desolating force. It was no longer the world, scarcely even a world. It was a planet, a star, a waste place in the universe, millions of miles from the world of men. It was impossible to recall what he had felt about Hyoi or Win, or the Eldila, or Oyarsa. It seemed fantastic to have thought he had duties to such hobgoblins, if they were not hallucinations met in the wilds of space. He had nothing to do with them. He was a man. Why had Weston and Divine left him alone like this? But all the time, the old resolution, taken when he could still think, was driving him up the road. Often he forgot where he was going and why. The movement became a mechanical rhythm, from weariness to stillness, from stillness to unbearable cold, from cold to motion again. He noticed that the Hadramit, now an insignificant part of the landscape, was full of a sort of haze. He had never seen a fog while he was living there. Perhaps that was what the air of the Hadramit looked like from above. Certainly it was very different air from this. There was something more wrong with his lungs and heart than even the cold and the exertion accounted for. And though there was no snow, there was an extraordinary brightness. The light was increasing, sharpening, and growing whiter, and the sky was a much darker blue than he had ever seen on Malacandra. Indeed, it was darker than blue. It was almost black, and the jagged spires of rock standing against it were like his mental picture of a lunar landscape. Some stars were visible. Suddenly he realized the meaning of these phenomena. There was very little air above him. He was near the end of it. The Malacandrian atmosphere lay chiefly in the Hadramit. The real surface of the planet was naked or thinly clad. The stabbing sunlight and the black sky above him were that heaven out of which he had dropped into the Malacandrian world, already showing through the last thin veil of air. If the top were more than 100 feet away, it would be where no man could breathe at all. He wondered whether the Hrossa had different lungs, and had sent him by a road that meant death for man. But even while he thought of this, he took note that those jagged peaks blazing in sunlight against an almost black sky were level with him. He was no longer ascending. The road ran on before him in a kind of shallow ravine, bounded on his left by the tops of the highest rock pinnacles, and on his right by a smooth ascending swell of stone that ran up to the true Harandra. And where he was, he could still breathe, though gasping, dizzy, and in pain. The blaze in his eyes was worse. The sun was setting. The Hrossa must have foreseen this. They could not live any more than he on the Harandra by night. Still staggering forward, he looked about him for any sign of Orgre's tower, whatever Orgre might be. Doubtless he exaggerated the time during which he thus wandered and watched the shadows from the rock lengthening towards him. It cannot really have been long before he saw a light ahead, a light which showed how dark the surrounding landscape had become. He tried to run, but his body would not respond. Stumbling in haste and weakness, he made for the light, thought he had reached it, and found that it was far farther off than he had supposed. Almost despaired, staggered on again, and came at last to what seemed a cavern mouth. The light within was an unsteady one, and a delicious wave of warmth smote on his face. It was firelight. He came into the mouth of the cave, and then, unsteadily, round the fire and into the interior, and stood still, blinking in the light. When at last he could see, he discerned a smooth chamber of green rock, very lofty. There were two things in it. One of them, dancing on the wall and roof, was the huge, angular shadow of a Sorn. The other, crouched beneath it, was the Sorn himself. Chapter 15. "Come in, small one," boomed the Sorn. "Come in and let me look at you." Now that he stood face to face with the spectre that had haunted him ever since he set foot on Malacandra, Ransom felt a surprising indifference. He had no idea what might be coming next, but he was determined to carry out his program. And in the meantime, the warmth and more breathable air were a heaven in themselves. He came in, well in past the fire, and answered the Sorn. His own voice sounded to him a shrill treble. "The Hrossa have sent me to look for Oyarsa," he said. The Sorn peered at him. "You are not from this world," it said suddenly. "No," replied Ransom, and sat down. He was too tired to explain. "I think you are from Thulkandra, small one," said the Sorn. "Why?" said Ransom. "You are small and thick, and that is how the animals ought to be made in a heavier world. You cannot come from Glundandra, for it is so heavy that if any animals could live there, they would be flat like plates. Even you, small one, would break if you stood up on that world. I do not think you are from Paralandra, for it must be very hot. If any came from there, they would not live when they arrived here. So I conclude you are from Thulkandra. The world I came from is called Earth by those who live there, said Ransom, and it is much warmer than this. Before I came into your cave, I was nearly dead with cold and thin air. The Sorn made a sudden movement with one of its long forelimbs. Ransom stiffened, though he did not allow himself to retreat, for the creature might be going to grab him. In fact, its intentions were kindly. Stretching back into the cave, it took from the wall what looked like a cup. Then Ransom saw that it was attached to a length of flexible tube. The Sorn put it into his hands. "Smell on this," it said. "The Hrossa also need it when they pass this way." Ransom inhaled and was instantly refreshed. His painful shortness of breath was eased, and the tension of chest and temples was relaxed. The Sorn and the lighted cavern, hitherto vague and dreamlike to his eyes, took on a new reality. "Oxygen?" he asked. But naturally, the English word meant nothing to the Sorn. "Are you called Orgrey?" he asked. "Yes," said the Sorn. "What are you called?" "The animal I am called is Man, and therefore the Hrossa call me Man. But my own name is Ransom."
"Man. Ransom," said the Sorn.
He noticed that it spoke differently from the Hrossa without any suggestion of their persistent initial H. It was sitting on its long, wedge-shaped buttocks, with its feet drawn up close to it. A man in the same posture would have rested his chin on his knees, but the Sorn's legs were too long for that. Its knees rose high above its shoulders on each side of its head, grotesquely suggestive of huge ears, and the head, down between them, rested its chin on the protruding breast. The creature seemed to have either a double chin or a beard. Ransom could not make out which in the firelight. It was mainly white or cream in colour, and seemed to be clothed down to the ankles in some soft substance that reflected the light. On the long, fragile shanks, where the creature was closest to him, he saw that this was some natural kind of coat. It was not like fur, but more like feathers. In fact, it was almost exactly like feathers. The whole animal, seen at close quarters, was less terrifying than he had expected, and even a little smaller. The face, it was true, took a good deal of getting used to. It was too long, too solemn, and too colourless, and it was much more unpleasantly like a human face than any inhuman creature's face ought to be. Its eyes, like those of all very large creatures, seemed too small for it. But it was more grotesque than horrible. A new conception of the Sorns began to arise in his mind. The ideas of giant and ghost receded behind those of goblin and gawk. "Perhaps you are hungry, small one," it said. Ransom was. The Sorn rose with strange, spidery movements and began going to and fro about the cave, attended by its thin goblin shadow. It brought him the usual vegetable foods of Malakandra and strong drink, with the very welcome addition of a smooth brown substance which revealed itself to nose, eye, and palate, in defiance of all probability, as cheese. Ransom asked what it was. The Sorn began to explain painfully how the female of some animal secreted a fluid for the nourishment of its young, and would have gone on to describe the whole process of milking and cheese-making if Ransom had not interrupted it. "Yes, yes," he said, "we do the same on Earth. What is the beast you use?"
"It is a yellow beast with a long neck. It feeds on the forests that grow in the Hadramit. The young ones of our people, who are not yet fit for much else, drive the beasts down there in the mornings and follow them while they feed. Then, before night, they drive them back and put them in the caves."
For a moment Ransom found something reassuring in the thought that the Sorns were shepherds. Then he remembered that the Cyclops in Homer plied the same trade. "I think I have seen one of your people at this very work," he said. "But the Hrossa, they let you tear up their forests?"
"Why should they not?"
"Do you rule the Hrossa?"
"Oyarsa rules them."
"And who rules you?"
"Oyarsa."
"But you know more than the Hrossa."
"The Hrossa know nothing except about poems and fish and making things grow out of the ground."
"And Oyarsa, is he a Sorn?"
"No, no, small one. I have told you he rules all now." So he pronounced, "now." "And everything in Malakandra."
"I do not understand this Oyarsa," said Ransom. "Tell me more."
"Oyarsa does not die," said the Sorn, "and he does not breed.
He is one of his kind who was put into Malakandra to rule it when Malakandra was made. His body is not like ours nor yours. It is hard to see, and the light goes through it.
Like an Eldil?
Yes. He is the greatest of Eldila who ever came to Ahandra. What are these Eldila?
Do you tell me, small one, that there are no Eldila in your world?
Not that I know of. But what are Eldila, and why can I not see them? Have they no bodies?
Of course they have bodies. There are a great many bodies you cannot see. Every animal's eyes see some things, but not others. Do you know how many kinds of body in Thulkandra?
Ransom tried to give the Sorn some idea of the terrestrial terminology of solids, liquids, and gases. It listened with great attention.
That is not the way to say it, it replied. Body is movement. If it is at one speed, you smell something. If at another, you hear a sound. If at another, you see a sight. If at another, you neither see, nor hear, nor smell, nor know the body in any way. But mark this, small one, that the two ends meet.
How do you mean?
If movement is faster, then that which moves is more nearly in two places at once.
But that is true.
But if the movement were faster still, it is difficult, for you do not know many words. You see that if you made it faster and faster, in the end the moving thing would be in all places at once, small one.
I think I see that.
Well then, that is the thing at the top of all bodies, so fast that it is at rest, so truly body that it has ceased being body at all. But we will not talk of that. Start from where we are, small one. The swiftest thing that touches our senses is light. We do not truly see light, we only see slower things lit by it, so that for us light is on the edge, the last thing we know before things become too swift for us.
But the body of an Eldil is a movement swift as light. You may say its body is made of light, but not of that which is light for the Eldil. His light is a swifter movement which for us is nothing at all. And what we call light is for him a thing like water, a visible thing, a thing he can touch and bathe in, even a dark thing when not illumined by the swifter. And what we call firm things, flesh and earth, seem to him thinner and harder to see than our light, and more like clouds and nearly nothing. To us the Eldil is a thin, half-real body that can go through walls and rocks. To himself he goes through them because he is solid and firm, and they are like cloud. And what is true light to him, and fills the heaven, so that he will plunge into the rays of the sun to refresh himself from it, is to us the black nothing in the sky at night. These things are not strange, small one, though they are beyond our senses. But it is strange that the Eldila never visit Thulkandra.
Of that I am not certain, said Ransom. It had dawned on him that the recurrent human tradition of bright, elusive people sometimes appearing on the earth, Albs, Devas, and the like, might, after all, have another explanation than the anthropologists had yet given. True, it would turn the universe rather oddly inside out, but his experiences in the spaceship had prepared him for some such operation.
Why does Oyarsa send for me? He asked.
Oyarsa has not told me, said the Sorn, but doubtless he would want to see any stranger from another Handra.
We have no Oyarsa in my world, said Ransom.
That is another proof, said the Sorn, that you come from Thulkandra, the silent planet.
What has that to do with it?
The Sorn seemed surprised. It is not very likely, if you had an Oyarsa, that he would never speak to ours.
Speak to yours? But how could he? It is millions of miles away.
Oyarsa would not think of it like that.
Do you mean that he ordinarily receives messages from other planets?
Once again, he would not say it that way. Oyarsa would not say that he lives on Malakandra and that another Oyarsa lives on another earth. For him, Malakandra is only a place in the heavens. It is in the heavens that he and the others live. Of course they talk together.
Ransom's mind shied away from the problem. He was getting sleepy and thought he must be misunderstanding the Sorn.
I think I must sleep, Orgrey, he said, and I do not know what you are saying. Perhaps, too, I do not come from what you call Thulkandra.
We will both sleep presently, said the Sorn, but first I will show you Thulkandra.
It rose, and Ransom followed it into the back of the cave. Here he found a little recess, and running up within it a winding stair. The steps, hewn for Sorns, were too high for a man to climb with any comfort, but using hands and knees he managed to hobble up. The Sorn preceded him.
Ransom did not understand the light, which seemed to come from some small round object which the creature held in its hand. They went up a long way, almost as if they were climbing up the inside of a hollow mountain. At last, breathless, he found himself in a dark but warm chamber of rock, and heard the Sorn saying, "She is still well above the southern horizon." It directed his attention to something like a small window. Whatever it was, it did not appear to work like an earthly telescope, Ransom thought. Though an attempt, made next day to explain the principles of the telescope to the Sorn, threw grave doubts on his own ability to discern the difference. He leaned forward with his elbows on the sill of the aperture and looked. He saw perfect blackness, and, floating in the centre of it, seemingly an arm's length away, a bright disk about the size of a half-crown. Most of its surface was featureless, shining silver. Towards the bottom, markings appeared, and below them a white cap, just as he had seen the polar caps in astronomical photographs of Mars. He wondered for a moment if it was Mars he was looking at. Then, as his eyes took in the markings better, he recognized what they were. Northern Europe and a piece of North America. They were upside down, with the North Pole at the bottom of the picture, and this somehow shocked him. But it was Earth he was seeing, even perhaps England, though the picture shook a little and his eyes were quickly getting tired, and he could not be certain that he was not imagining it. It was all there in that little disk. London, Athens, Jerusalem, Shakespeare. There everyone had lived and everything had happened, and there, presumably, his pack was still lying in the porch of an empty house near Stirk. "Yes," he said dully to the Sorn, "that is my world." It was the bleakest moment in all his travels. Chapter 16 Ransom awoke next morning with the vague feeling that a great weight had been taken off his mind. Then he remembered that he was the guest of a Sorn, and that the creature he had been avoiding ever since he landed had turned out to be as amicable as the Hrossa, though he was far from feeling the same affection for it. Nothing then remained to be afraid of in Malakandra except Oyarsa. The last fence, thought Ransom. Orgrey gave him food and drink. "And now," said Ransom, "how shall I find my way to Oyarsa?" "I will carry you," said the Sorn. "You are too small a one to make the journey yourself, and I will gladly go to Meldilorn. The Hrossa should not have sent you this way. They do not seem to know from looking at an animal what sort of lungs it has and what it can do. It is just like a Hross. If you died on the Harandra, they would have made a poem about the gallant man, and how the sky grew black and the cold stars shone, and he journeyed on and journeyed on, and they would have put in a fine speech for you to say as you were dying. And all this would seem to them just as good as if they had used a little forethought and saved your life by sending you the easier way round." "I like the Hrossa," said Ransom a little stiffly, "and I think the way they talk about death is the right way." "They are right not to fear it, Rensum, but they do not seem to look at it reasonably as part of the very nature of our bodies, and therefore often avoidable at times, when they would never see how to avoid it. For example, this has saved the life of many a Hross, but a Hross would not have thought of it." He showed Ransom a flask with a tube attached to it, and at the end of the tube a cup, obviously an apparatus for administering oxygen to oneself. "Smell on it as you have need, small one," said the Sorn, "and close it up when you do not." Orgrey fastened the thing on his back and gave the tube over his shoulder into his hand. Ransom could not restrain a shudder at the touch of the Sorn's hands upon his body. They were fan-shaped, seven-fingered, mere skin over bone like a bird's leg, and quite cold. To divert his mind from such reactions, he asked where the apparatus was made, for he had as yet seen nothing remotely like a factory or a laboratory. "We thought it," said the Sorn, "and the Fifeltriggy made it." "Why do they make them?" said Ransom. He was trying once more, with his insufficient vocabulary, to find out the political and economic framework of Malakandrian life. "They like making things," said Orgrey. "It is true they like best the making of things that are only good to look at and of no use, but sometimes, when they are tired of that, they will make things for us, things we have thought, provided they are difficult enough. They have not the patience to make easy things, however useful they would be. But let us begin our journey. You shall sit on my shoulder." The proposal was unexpected and alarming, but seeing that the Sorn had already crouched down, Ransom felt obliged to climb onto the plume-like surface of its shoulder to seat himself beside the long, pale face, casting his right arm as far as it would go round the huge neck, and to compose himself as well as he could for this precarious mode of travel. The giant rose cautiously to a standing position, and he found himself looking down on the landscape from a height of about 18 feet. "Is all well, small one?" it asked. "Very well," Ransom answered, and the journey began. Its gait was perhaps the least human thing about it. It lifted its feet very high and set them down very gently. Ransom was reminded alternately of a cat stalking, a strutting barn-door fowl, and a high-stepping carriage horse. But the movement was not really like that of any terrestrial animal. For the passenger it was surprisingly comfortable. In a few minutes he had lost all sense of what was dizzying or unnatural in his position. Instead, ludicrous and even tender associations came crowding into his mind. It was like riding an elephant at the zoo in boyhood, like riding on his father's back at a still earlier age. It was fun. They seemed to be doing between 6 and 7 miles an hour. The cold, though severe, was endurable, and, thanks to the oxygen, he had little difficulty with his breathing. The landscape which he saw from his high, swaying post of observation was a solemn one. The Hadramit was nowhere to be seen. On each side of the shallow gully in which they were walking, a world of naked, faintly greenish rock, interrupted with wide patches of red, extended to the horizon. The heaven, darkest blue where the rock met it, was almost black at the zenith, and looking in any direction where sunlight did not blind him, he could see the stars. He learned from the Sorn that he was right in thinking they were near the limits of the breathable. Already on the mountain fringe that borders the Harandra and walls the Hadramit, or in the narrow depression along which their road led them, the air is of Himalayan rarity, ill-breathing for a Hross, and a few hundred feet higher on the Harandra proper, the true surface of the planet, it admits no life. Hence the brightness through which they walked was almost that of heaven, celestial light hardly at all tempered with an atmospheric veil. The shadow of the Sorn, with Ransom's shadow on its shoulder, moved over the uneven rock unnaturally distinct, like the shadow of a tree before the headlights of a car. And the rock beyond the shadow hurt his eyes. The remote horizon seemed but an arm's length away. The fissures and moulding of distant slopes were clear as the background of a primitive picture made before men learned perspective. He was on the very frontier of that heaven he had known in the spaceship, and rays that the air-enveloped worlds cannot taste were once more at work upon his body. He felt the old lift of the heart, the soaring solemnity, the sense, at once sober and ecstatic, of life and power offered in unasked and unmeasured abundance. If there had been air enough in his lungs, he would have laughed aloud. And now, even in the immediate landscape, beauty was drawing near. Over the edge of the valley, as it had frothed down from the true Harandra, came great curves of the rose-tinted cumular stuff which he had seen so often from a distance. Now, on a nearer view, they appeared hard as stone in substance, but puffed above and stalked beneath like vegetation. His original simile of giant cauliflower turned out to be surprisingly correct. Stone cauliflowers the size of cathedrals and the colour of pale rose. He asked the Sorn what it was. "It is the old forests of Malacandra," said Orgre. "Once there was air on the Harandra, and it was warm. To this day, if you could get up there and live, you would see it all covered with the bones of ancient creatures. It was once full of life and noise. It was then these forests grew, and in and out among their stalks went a people that have vanished from the world these many thousand years. They were covered not with fur, but with a coat like mine. They did not go in the water swimming or on the ground walking. They glided in the air on broad, flat limbs which kept them up. It is said they were great singers, and in those days the red forests echoed with their music. Now the forests have become stone, and only Eldila can go among them." "We still have such creatures in our world," said Ransom. "We call them birds. Where was Oyasa when all this happened to the Harandra?"
"Where he is now."
"And he could not prevent it?"
"I do not know. But a world is not made to last forever, much less a race. That is not Maleldil's way."
As they proceeded, the petrified forests grew more numerous, and often, for half an hour at a time, the whole horizon of the lifeless, almost airless waste blushed like an English garden in summer. They passed many caves where, as Orgre told him, Saurons lived. Sometimes a high cliff would be perforated with countless holes to the very top, and unidentifiable noises came hollowly from within. Work was in progress, said the Sauron, but of what kind it could not make him understand. Its vocabulary was very different from that of the Hrossa. Nowhere did he see anything like a village or city of Saurons, who were apparently solitary, not social creatures. Once or twice a long, pallid face would show from a cavern mouth and exchange a horn-like greeting with the travellers. But for the most part the long valley, the rock street of the silent people, was still and empty as the Harandra itself. Only towards afternoon, as they were about to descend into a dip of the road, they met three Saurons together, coming towards them down the opposite slope. They seemed to Ransom to be rather skating than walking. The lightness of their world and the perfect poise of their bodies allowed them to lean forward at right angles to the slope, and they came swiftly down like full-rigged ships before a fair wind. The grace of their movement, their lofty stature, and the softened glancing of the sunlight on their feathery sides effected a final transformation in Ransom's feelings towards their race. Ogres, he had called them when they first met his eyes as he struggled in the grip of Western and Divine. Titans, or angels, he now thought would have been a better word. Even the faces, it seemed to him, he had not then seen aright. He had thought them spectral when they were only august, and his human reaction to their lengthened severity of line and profound stillness of expression now appeared to him not so much cowardly as vulgar. So might Parmenides or Confucius look to the eyes of a Cockney schoolboy. The great white creatures sailed towards Ransom and Orgre and dipped like trees and passed. In spite of the cold, which made him often dismount and take a spell on foot, he did not wish for the end of the journey. But Orgre had his own plans and halted for the night long before sundown at the home of an older Saurn. Ransom saw well enough that he was brought there to be shown to a great scientist. The cave, or, to speak more correctly, the system of excavations, was large and many-chambered, and contained a multitude of things that he did not understand. He was specially interested in a collection of rolls, seemingly of skin, covered with characters which were clearly books. But he gathered that books were few in Malacandra. "It is better to remember," said the Saurons. When Ransom asked if valuable secrets might not thus be lost, they replied that Oyarsa always remembered them, and would bring them to light if he thought fit. "The Hrossa used to have many books of poetry," they added, "but now they have fewer. They say that the writing of books destroys poetry." Their host in these caverns was attended by a number of other Saurons, who seemed to be in some way subordinate to him. Ransom thought at first that they were servants, but decided later that they were pupils or assistants. The evening's conversation was not such as would interest a terrestrial reader, for the Saurons had determined that Ransom should not ask, but answer, questions. Their questioning was very different from the rambling inquiries of the Hrossa. They worked systematically from the geology of Earth to its present geography, and thence in turn to flora, fauna, human history, languages, politics, and arts. When they found that Ransom could tell them no more on a given subject, and this happened pretty soon in most of their inquiries, they dropped it at once and went on to the next. Often they drew out of him indirectly much more knowledge than he consciously possessed, apparently working from a wide background of general science. A casual remark about trees when Ransom was trying to explain the manufacture of paper would fill up for them a gap in his sketchy answers to their botanical questions. His account of terrestrial navigation might illuminate mineralogy, and his description of the steam engine gave them a better knowledge of terrestrial air and water than Ransom had ever had. He had decided from the outset that he would be quite frank, for he now felt that it would not be now, and also that it would be unavailing to do otherwise. They were astonished at what he had to tell them of human history, of war, slavery, and prostitution. "It is because they have no Oyarsa," said one of the pupils. "It is because every one of them wants to be a little Oyarsa himself," said Orgre. "They cannot help it," said the old Saurn. "There must be rule. Yet how can creatures rule themselves? Beasts must be ruled by Hnau, and Hnau by Eldila, and Eldila by Meleldil. These creatures have no Eldila. They are like one trying to lift himself by his own hair, or one trying to see over a whole country when he is on a level with it, like a female trying to beget young on herself." Two things about our world particularly stuck in their minds. One was the extraordinary degree to which problems of lifting and carrying things absorbed our energy. The other was the fact that we had only one kind of knau. They thought this must have far-reaching effects in the narrowing of sympathies, and even of thought. "Your thought must be at the mercy of your blood," said the old Sorn, "for you cannot compare it with thought that floats on a different blood." It was a tiring and very disagreeable conversation for Ransom. But when at last he lay down to sleep, it was not of the human nakedness nor of his own ignorance that he was thinking. He thought only of the old forests of Malacandra, and of what it might mean to grow up seeing always so few miles away a land of colour that could never be reached and had once been inhabited.